Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pollock and Thurston, where Post Wrestling and WrestleNomics come together for our weekly summit, and I think our two countries on their best behavior this week as newly elected Prime Minister Mark Carney sitting down with President Donald Trump this week, very gracious in front of the media, as Mark Carney subtly noted, not everything is for sale.
Well, the U.S. does very little business with Canada anyway, so it's nice for your chief governmental official to be invited in that situation. You should be thankful.
Yes. It was. It was. I do enjoy the fact that these previous like closed door meetings. Now they're just out in front of the cameras. Like we're actively going to, and you may get a disaster like Zelensky.
It makes for great TV, though.
I mean, what else is government officials there for than to make great television? So,
all right. Yes. So I wanted to follow up on my understanding of Canadian, how the Canadian government works. And you were struggling to explain to me that Mark Carney he's the prime minister, but with a minority.
He has a correct? Minority government. Yes.
So I haven't looked into this at all, but I think I figured out what you were trying to say. So he does have a minority, but I bet you have more than two parties there. Is that what's happening?
Correct. Correct. Yes.
So he has a plurality. He has the most.
Yes.
Whatever.
Yes.
But he doesn't have more than 50%. He doesn't have 50%.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's a lot more of a simplistic civics lesson.
See, what we have three major parties or what?
Well, we have the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party are the two dominant parties right now. The third significant party is... Well, we have the Bloc Québécois.
Oh, right.
And we have the NDP. But the NDP failed to get enough seats to have official party status. They took a real drubbing in this election with a lot of belief that this is a two-party race and the NDP kind of fell apart. But yes, it is a multi-party system. And those would be your four parties. The Green Party, they show up for participation trophies.
Yeah. So some are saying that you have five parties. So is that, did you just go through five parties there?
Yes, with the NDP, Bloc Québécois, yes. And Green Party.
Okay.
Yeah, we also have like other fringe parties as well. You could have voted for the Communist Party. Didn't get too much support in Canada last week. But
okay.
Yeah. I think we should do this every week. I think we should start every show off with a civics course. In American and Canadian relations, you and I can successfully bring our two countries together and to be in lockstep. Not that we will be purchasing either side, but that we can be cohesive partners in the wrestling space.
Yeah, we could work on that, and hopefully that way. I mean, this program has so much influence as it is that it's only natural that will extend soon to. International affairs.
Oh, the key people are listening, Brandon. We're aware of that. They won't come on, but they're listening. Yeah. Before we get into just a deluge of topics, I want to go back. A week ago, we were speaking here, and you were about to participate at the University at Buffalo discussion on current Department of Secretary Head Linda McMahon, along with Brian Solomon and Lavi Margolin. How did this go last week?
It was good. There is another education minister whose name I'm gonna find here. It was a good time. There was a little bit less than 93,179 people there at the auditorium, the lecture hall. But it was a good time. We spoke about Linda McMahon and said things that would be not new information for people listening to this. And then we went to Fuji Grill afterwards, and we hung out and talked about. We talked about wrestling. We talked about Brian Solomon's time writing trivia questions for the WWE trivia game and my experiences playing that trivia game. But it was a good time.
Yes, Brian Solomon. He's in the midst of writing a book on Gorilla Monsoon that is that is coming out soon. And
yes,
were a lot of the questions mainly focused on sort of the current political climate and Linda's role? Did they delve into a lot of her WWE past? Like, what was the sense you got from just some of the questions you guys were fielding?
Well, we didn't get any questions.
Oh, okay. This was more just
a discussion. Talking.
Okay.
For quite a while. Yes.
All right. Well, wish I could have made it. Sounds fun.
Dr. Schiller is the education.
Harvey? Teacher.
No, not Harvey. Oh, okay.
Well, we look forward to future
Dr. Jennifer Schiller. Yes.
Jennifer Schiller. Well, maybe you'll be doing the college tour at some point. Maybe if
I'm open to more speaking engagements. We can negotiate a speaking engagement fee that is fair for everyone.
All right, we have a lot to get into. A bunch of stuff has dropped. We're going to start off with a bunch of legal cases, and we'll do our best to make sense of them for everyone out there. And then Brandon, who teased this last week, has undertaken one of the most insane projects I could ever imagine through the help of Leon White. We now have pythons, Vader, all of these tools that have helped you go through what, 40 million Reddit comments?
Well, for this study in particular, it was 4.99 million, 5 million comments. And you didn't reply to my email. I suggested that we start off by just reading them so everyone has a sufficient background. You didn't reply to my email.
That's because I was curating all of the comments. I'm like Chris Jericho with the list of 1,004 holds.
Yes.
We'll go comment by comment and get to the discourse that happens on Reddit. So all of that to come. Let us start off with the Janelle Grant case, because there is some movement in this case. It was several months ago, after the stay had been lifted, that Janelle Grant and her team filed an amended complaint, and this included new details. It also revealed several of the names that had previously been redacted in the original complaint, and now Judge Sarah Russell has, in fact, granted the amended complaint to be filed within the next week so that they can move forward with this amended complaint that the defendants had been arguing they could not. And the judge went through several of the boxes you need to check in order for an amended complaint to be turned down after the sufficient time period. And they were not able to demonstrate that any of those concerns were of note in this ruling.
Right. So the amended complaint, I don't expect it's going to be a different version. That's going to be the operative complaint going forward. In January, we reported on it, and plenty of people have reported on what the amended complaint consists of. It has de-anonymized some of the people who were under pseudonyms previously, including WWE executives, some of them former, some of them current, including Nick Khan. So it added some allegations. It added some pictures of Vince in a conference room that's taken from the Netflix documentary. It added an image of a diagram of WWE headquarters showing just how, you know, showing that Janelle Grant was actually sharing an office or had an office that was connected to John Laurinaitis' office, which happened to be right next door to Paul Levesque's office. So it extended the complaint by many pages. I expect that there'll be no changes to this amended complaint, and this will become the operative complaint going forward. This is not really a surprise that this has been approved. But another important part of what was ruled on today by Judge Russell is about discovery. Discovery is one of the legal terms of art that we're learning here on this program every week. Discovery is when the parties involved in a lawsuit or even a criminal case, this is not a criminal case, though this is just a civil lawsuit, they start to exchange evidence that is pertinent to the dispute. And the defendants had a few weeks ago asked the court to put a stay on that to prevent that from happening. Grant's lawyers came back and said, we would like at least a limited discovery as it concerns the motion to compel arbitration, or other favorite word. The defendants want this case to go away into private arbitration, not in public court. And basically what the judge did today was say, yes, we're not going to get into some general conducting of discovery here, but General Grant does have the right to ask for discovery once the motions to compel arbitration are refiled. That should happen by June 13th. At that point, they've already filed these in the past, but because of other legal maneuvers, those have been put away. They will almost certainly refile by June 13th, at which point General Grant could ask for discovery that pertains to arbitration, pertains to the issue about whether arbitration can be enforced, because, of course, General Grant and Vince McMahon signed this NDA, this agreement that had a number of clauses in it, including you will release Vince and WWE from liability, you will not discuss this non-disclosure agreement, hush money payment, all that stuff. But it also had an arbitration clause so that disputes should be handled in private and not in public court where we are now. That's what the defendants are definitely pointing to there. But what Grant is going to be allowed to do is request discovery related to that issue itself. Is there any legal reason why arbitration should not be enforced? So presumably she will. The parties are supposed to try to resolve this on their own. If they cannot, they can ask the judge to make a decision. So I would guess that that's probably what's going to happen here ultimately.
You don't see them all just figuring this out on their own.
Who knows? Maybe they will come to some sort of agreement in amicable terms earlier.
Yeah, McMahon had said that Grant unduly delayed her motion to amend, thereby caused undue prejudice to the defendants, and McMahon further posits that the amendments are made in bad faith, suggesting they are designed to capture media interest rather than strengthen Grant's substantive legal arguments. McMahon points in particular to Grant's decision to de-anonymize individuals in her proposed amended complaint as evidence of Grant's assertedly bad faith efforts to gain a tactical advantage in the court of public opinion. The defendants further submit that Grant's proposed amendments are futile, maintaining that none of her amendments will affect the court's assessment of the defendant's planned motion to compel arbitration. Judge Russell went through all of the areas of which they would have to argue and found that she was not convinced that the amendments are offered in bad faith. It is certainly clear that some of Grant's proposed amendments include facts she knew or should have known when she filed the complaint, but her newly pleaded facts do not deprive the defendants of their ability to timely assert that her claims are subject to arbitration. I accordingly decline to find her amendments are in bad faith.
Yes. So, I mean, one of the issues it seems like is important to this legal argument is whether or not you're just raising new claims altogether, not just adding details, which is mainly the latter is what the amended complaint consists of. The former, if you're adding these new claims and if you're adding in things that under their test would not withstand a motion to dismiss, it would be viewed as just trying to delay the process. And in that case, you could have your request to amend your complaint get dismissed or get denied. And that's not what's happened here.
Yeah. And that would be one of the questions to raise of why the corporate officers were anonymized in the initial complaint and then revealed in the amended complaint. Like, they could have made that argument. Then there were other aspects, such as, like, there was a significant portion that is reliant on the Netflix documentary.
Well, and the SEC ruling that happened just this past January.
And that as well, that is brought up. That is more timely as well.
Yeah, where Vince has been essentially fined some money for not properly disclosing what was going on with the for causing WWE to have to correct their financial statements because he didn't disclose that he was paying millions of dollars to at least two women. This caused WWE to correct their financial statements, etc. You can't do that when you're a publicly traded company, and the SEC penalized him some money and forced him to repay WWE.
Also, an individual who was anonymized just as celebrity doctor in the original complaint, of course, that has come out as Dr. Carlin Kolker and his Peak Wellness facility. This has been a back and forth that has been going on for months at this point, where Janelle Grant's team has been requesting the full medical records of her time seeing Dr. Carlin Kolker. Kolker's side has maintained that they have provided all of these records, and it's just a matter of whether the complete records have been turned over. That seems to be at the crux of the argument. But Dr. Carlin Kolker, over this past week, who is represented by several attorneys, including Alejandro Brito, who had represented Donald Trump in his case for defamation against ABC that they settled out of court for $15 million. So that's who's representing Kolker, among others. And on Friday, they filed a defamation case in the U.S. District Court in Connecticut against Ann Callis and her Holland law firm, stating that they have been that they had engaged in an extrajudicial campaign to disseminate false and defamatory statements concerning Dr. Kolker and Peak Wellness, specifically noting the October 15th press conference that was held last year by Ann Callis and her team, and with Callis issuing a press release to media outlets during which she disseminated false and defamatory statements about the plaintiffs. These statements included claims that the plaintiffs engaged in unlawful and unethical medical practices, including but not limited to forcing a patient to accept infusions, routinely breaking doctor-patient trust, allowing unauthorized access to medical records, and improperly withholding a patient's medical records. They state that these were false statements and that Callis was undeniably aware of their falsity, as she was in possession of medical records that directly contradicted her claims. They are disputing all of the allegations that Janelle Grant's team has made against Kolker and his facility, and also including as exhibits here the medical records that have been turned over with three different dates that there were documents passed over to Grant's team.
Well, I don't think the medical records themselves have been included as exhibits, but records of the transmissions. We have receipts where, and we have even emails from the Grant side acknowledging receipt of records that the Kolker side has given to the Grant side.
And the Grant team had originally stated they had received written records, and this is brought up in the lawsuit that they have provided written records, but then they also submitted electronic records. So they are arguing that all of their records, all of their metadata has been transferred to Grant. They have complied throughout this and have been defamed in the process.
Yes. And to be clear, so this is not a lawsuit against Janelle Grant. Janelle Grant is not even mentioned. Her name is anonymized as patient in Dr. Kolker's lawsuit here. I can only guess that that's to protect the patient-doctor relationship. He's not suing Janelle Grant. He's suing Janelle Grant's lawyer here. He takes issue, especially with things that happened on October 15th, which, as you mentioned, there was a media conference, a conference call with media that day where she made a number of statements. And he's also taking issue with a written statement that Anna Callis provided to media where she says, "Imagine being at your most vulnerable and the doctor you are told to see only makes you feel worse. Our filing today makes clear that Dr. Kolker violated ethical and medical standards when he injected unknown substances into Janelle's body and directed her to take unlabeled pills while dismissing her basic questions about those drugs. Peak Wellness owes Janelle Grant answers, and the clinic's secrecy and evasion must come to an end." So statements like that, as well as statements she made on the call, is especially what he's taking issue with. And he's alleging that this has caused him harm to his reputation and untold financial harm because, he's a doctor, and his clinic is also a named plaintiff here along with him, his business. And this has caused damage to trust, and presumably it's caused him to have trouble, attracting patients and doing his business.
Do you find it at all noteworthy that Janelle Grant is not named as a defendant in this?
Like I said, I can only guess it's to protect HIPAA concerns, maybe, or to protect the patient doctor relationship.
Because, like, for Ann Callis, it's interesting. Like, she is relaying the case of her client.
It's very obvious who, there's no plausible way that this could be anybody else.
No, not at all. I just look at it as though, like, these are the accusations made by Janelle Grant. This is that's an interesting part of this case as well. But yeah, as you mentioned, Gerald Grant is not actually named in any of this. And it just goes over the timeline as well that Janelle Grant began seeing Kolker in November of 2019, received medical care at least 60 times over the next 2.5 years. Not mentioned in this case either, but had been brought up in the complaint, was that it was Kolker who had recommended a lawyer to Janelle Grant as well, that they got into that as well.
Jonathan M. Shapiro, we believe.
Yes, who was representing Grant before Ann Callis as well. And the inference being that it was like that Kolker and Vince McMahon were working together here, and Kolker was acting as like a go-between for legal representation for Janelle Grant to negotiate.
So this would be the lawyer who she worked with when the NDA was being negotiated between Grant and McMahon, so early 2022. We should mention, too, there's been three different lawsuits involving Dr. Kolker here that we've been following. Originally back in July, just after the federal case involving Grant and Vince, which we were talking about earlier, when that was put on hold pending an investigation from the Southern District of New York, which has never unfolded into any criminal charges. While that was being put on hold, the federal lawsuit was being put on hold. Grant filed a petition in state court in Connecticut. That case is still pending. She's trying to extract records. That's sort of where this part of this dispute unfolds from, is where she has been trying to request records. Kolker saying, "I've given you all the records multiple times." And then Kolker filed his own petition against Grant shortly after, about a month and a half or so, and then withdrew it about a month later. We still don't have a clear answer about why that was. So this is where we're at. We're following cases now that are sort of tangentially related to Vince, but they are relevant to the broader story here, because Dr. Kolker is somebody who allegedly Vince paid for and directed Janelle Grant to get treatment at. It's alleged by Grant that someone from his office, not Dr. Kolker, but someone else from his office, also participated in sexual assault against her along with Vince.
Yeah, and just going back to what is outlined here in Kolker's filing, as evidenced in the medical records, at no point was the patient forced to undergo intravenous infusions. At no point was the patient ever administered or directed to take unknown substances by way of an intravenous route, orally or otherwise. At no point was the patient directed to take unlabeled drugs. At no point did Dr. Kolker personally administer any injections to the patient, and at no point did the patient report experiencing any adverse effects related to her treatment. So, I mean, this is not just like some gray area. They are arguing the complete opposite of what is argued or of what is being alleged against Kolker. There does not appear to be a whole lot of ambiguity here from Kolker's side, that not only was there no misinterpretation, like this clearly, as they are stating, none of this occurred as is alleged.
Yes.
So we have one side against the other. And add this to the expanding web of the Janelle Grant case.
Yes.
Let's move on to case number 3. A good old-fashioned shareholders lawsuit filed against WWE and Vince McMahon over the handling of the 2023 merger between the WWE and the UFC. What are these shareholders arguing? This is not a new case. This had been filed quite a ways back, but there is an update in terms of the discovery process.
Yeah, so this is a case that originally started all the way back in, I believe, November 2023. So this is a year and a half case that's been running. The shareholders is a group of shareholders that intend to represent all shareholders over a given class period. They're alleging that Vince McMahon, this is basically their allegation, Vince McMahon, you forced your way back into the company, and you started this strategic review process where you were considering selling or merging the company, and you didn't do that in an honest manner. You predetermined ahead of time that you were only going to work with Ari Emanuel and Endeavor, who is your longtime friend and an associate. You decided that you were just going to work with him because you knew that any other suitor, any other party that was going to potentially buy WWE was never going to allow you to stay in the company. That is basically their allegation, because of the reason why purportedly Vince would not be allowed to stay is because of the sexual misconduct allegations against him. So this has been going for a while. Anybody who came anywhere near this case, you know, and any of the advisors, that is, you know, the JP Morgans and all these advisement firms that were involved in it, they've all been subpoenaed. The board members of the board of directors have been subpoenaed. And to be clear here, who are the defendants here? It's Vince, it's WWE, and it's some members of the board of directors, I believe, including Nick Khan, George Barrios, Michelle Wilson, and Steve Coonan might still be. I would have to look. We probably have it on the screen here. But anyway, they allege that this wasn't a fair process that led to the merger. So they've all been subpoenaed, and Vince is apparently resisting the kind of discovery that they want to conduct. And we didn't have a lot of detail. There was a sealed version of their filing that has since had a public version of it now released just today. So I haven't written anything on this anywhere yet. You're getting the most current information that I have right now. So they're alleging that there's been this discussion earlier this year between the plaintiff's side and Vince's side, and they're going back and forth negotiating on what the scope of discovery is going to be. So they wrote that the responses, this is from Vince's attorneys, asserted that the sexual misconduct allegations are unrelated and immaterial to the party's claims and defenses, and that the discovery materials related to the sexual misconduct topics would only be produced if it was also if they were also discussing the merger process and or Vince's pro forma role in the company. So basically Vince is saying, you're requesting these, you know, information related to sexual misconduct allegations. I'm not going to give you that unless it's related to the merger process, unless it's related to my discussions with other quote unquote decision makers. There's a lot to this. I've just read it just before going to air here. He's also potentially trying to narrow the timeline of the discovery. They are requesting everything from January 1st, 2022 to mid-March 2024. So that would take us, you know, what, a month and a half after the Grant lawsuit is filed and he resigns for the probably final time.
Here are 3 years of Vince McMahon emails. Have at it.
I don't know how all this works, but they mention here too in one search that Vince's side was willing to do, they produced something like 5,000 records. So a lot of records potentially involved in discovery. Not all this discovery does not get made public, but if they find something that they believe is relevant to their case, those things tend to be added as exhibits. So maybe we will see some of the most relevant materials potentially. We'll see. There's discussion here about text messages. So any written communication is probably discoverable. So we'll, unless it's privileged, and it doesn't seem that he's actually claiming attorney client privilege, as we know in yet another case. We should count up all the cases involving events. There was this appeals court case related to the potential criminal case against Vince. Again, no charges have been filed, but Vince cited attorney-client privilege related to communications records involving himself and Jerry McDivitt, his former longtime attorney. He was claiming privilege on those, so he would not have to turn them over as part of that investigation. And the court ruled that no, there's probable cause for fraud. The criminal fraud exemption was in play there, and there was, you know, probable cause for fraud here as it related to defrauding shareholders, I suppose. The court ruled on that. There was an appeal in appeals court. The appeals court agreed that there's probable cause here. So whatever communications were happening between Vince and McDivitt presumably would be eligible for discovery. You should be able to tell your lawyer things in confidence, but not to then, you know, conduct potentially illegal actions.
Certainly the discovery phase is going to be, I think, concerning to their side. But I look at a whole of this shareholder lawsuit. And again, I'm not a legal expert in this field, but I just don't see this having like any significant merit to it. Like, I think this is a very, very winnable case to argue the fact that, number one, look at
me about the discovery issue in particular.
No, I'm just looking at the overall arguments in this shareholder case that they did not conduct their fiduciary duty in terms of a valuable deal for the company. They were able, Vince McMahon was able to extract a larger percentage out of this from Ari Emanuel. The value of the company has grown exponentially. And if you're arguing that you discounted other options because Vince McMahon would be absorbed into this new company, well, let's look at Vince McMahon's current state. Like, there were not safeguards for Vince McMahon in this new company, and he had to give up his voting, his super shares, and he is out of his company at this point. I just don't think you can look at this as an argument that shareholders were defrauded in this. Like, they can make the argument that yes, the day of we could have just had a strict buyout from a larger company, but I think over the long haul, you have to look at this. This was arguably the best deal on the table for WWE as an entity.
There's information in WWE's filings around the time just after the merger where they explain their narrative of how this merger came to be. And there were cash offers. The merger was a different deal than the other offers that they got. The other offers that they got were potentially for buying the whole company. The UFC WWE merger is what's called an all stock deal. There's no money that changed hands. They simply took UFC out of Endeavor and connected it to WWE. So that essentially WWE shareholders became both WWE and UFC shareholders. And Endeavor just gained a lot of what was formerly WWE stock to go along with the value of their UFC ownership. It would depend on how serious and how strong those offers are, I guess. But yes, it's an important point that Vince did give up his super shares. He did give up his preferred voting shares that gave, remember, each one of his shares 10 times the voting power of everybody else's shares, where he was able to force his way back into the company in January 2023 while only owning 36% of the company, because despite owning 36% of the company, his special voting shares gave him 81% of the voting power. So wherever he wanted, went. And somebody did ask me, why is Vince required? He did have controlling ownership. Why does he have any obligation to, as the plaintiffs are arguing, to get the best deal for the company? It would be different if this was a private company. If this was a private company that was not trying to sell its shares to the public market, he would be able to more freely do what he wants. But when you're a publicly traded company, and when you're an officer or a director of the company, and he was the executive chairman of the company upon his return to the company, you have an obligation to try to produce long-term value for your shareholders, regardless of your personal ownership, regardless of whether you're the biggest shareholder, which Vince was. Board members get shares, and that's supposed to align their interests, supposed to encourage them to act more in shareholders' interest because they are shareholders. But nonetheless, you can still have issues where, as they allege, as these shareholder plaintiffs allege, that Vince was acting in the interest of his control and power and not the value of the shares that he held.
I think if we ever do write the definitive Vince McMahon book on this whole last 3 years, I think the title will be "If This Was a Private Company." ...
And another thing that we should discuss here, right, is I think this would have implications for whether discovery happens here or not, and to what extent it does. I would think this would have implications for the Grant case. We've already seen the Grant case. Look at the SEC settlement that Vince came to with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
They're both after very similar correspondence. Yeah. They're both in this discovery phase and looking pretty much for the same thing, and there's going to be tremendous overlap.
Yeah, they're looking for information related to what they call the hush payments and sexual misconduct allegations. These were issues that directly involved Janelle Grant.
All right. Anything else you wanted to touch upon on the legal front before we head off to the swamp that is Reddit?
We'll leave the legal department now and go over to the data and sentiment department, I guess.
All right. You talked a bit about this last week, so in plain language, can you explain, first of all, Brandon, did you just wake up one day and think, what does Reddit have to say about WWE and AEW, and how long of a project was this? Like, I sometimes see stuff you do, and like, I can't even wrap my head around how you conducted this, but I am in awe. I think this is one of your finest studies.
So let's see. When did I start? I downloaded these files for the first time on April 25th. So that
this
was
a very short term project.
Yeah, I thought I was going to get it done real quick. So last week was what was the date of
April 30th.
April 30th. So yeah, I mean, this wasn't that hard. I thought I was done with it for the last 10 days or so. And then I continued to realize I needed to do something more and something more to do it properly. So as I've written in the article, which is free for everybody to read on RussellOnyx.com, there's this great resource. Actually, what I was doing is I was looking at, ironically enough, I was looking at Reddit itself, and I was looking at, there's this great subreddit called Data is Beautiful. And somebody posted something in there about looking at different subreddits and measuring the sentiment of them. And I don't know if they used Vader or not, but they...
Can you explain what Vader is? Is this like an AI tool?
I will.
Okay.
So they got all the data from this website called Academic Torrents, where you can just... apparently, there's this website that's, you know, relied on by academics and universities, where they have just apparently scraped Reddit, which is not easy to do. This isn't... Maybe their previous version of their API would allow it, but they've got all of this, every comment on every subreddit. So and lo and behold, they have Squared Circle, which is the most popular subreddit, I think. The WWE subreddit has a similar number of subscribers, but apparently not as much activity. In any case, so I downloaded the entire history of Squared Circle beginning in 2005 through the end of 2024. That is a 72.1 gigabyte JSON file, and I didn't need all that history to focus on. You know, there's a lot of opportunities here for doing interesting analysis. This is just one splice of a project that I decided to focus on. Focusing on what? Sentiment of WWE and, of course, AEW. So to do that, I decided, well, we've got some 5 million comments. Really, we've got whatever I wrote, 40 some odd million comments in this timeline. I decided I'm going to take the timeline since I'm going to do W and AW here. Let's take like October, because you'll have to remind me, because I was more deeply involved in this than most people, but that nobody was really aware of AW until the fall or so.
Of 2018?
Of 2018, that, yes.
Yeah, I mean, post All In, that's when you were starting to get stories that were coming out about who was involved.
Like Jericho was saying stuff, right?
Jericho's name was linked. Jim Ross's name was linked. Barry Bloom's name was linked. Like, you were certainly getting... It was not as a case of, like, the New Year's Eve video reveal by Cody and the Bucks and Hangman at the Tokyo Dome was the first. Like, that was the first time we publicly heard AEW. But, you know, some of these trademarks had come out.
Right.
I mean, you were covering it with Chris at the time.
Yes.
I imagine he had heard some hints about...
I imagine he had heard some things. There's a podcast from very late in 2018 that we did together where he's saying some things that he clearly knows much more about than he's saying. So, and to be clear what we're talking about here, I did some research for the project that eventually became known as AEW in 2018. I've not done any such work since, despite some efforts by some people to get me to do so. So I started in late 2018 just to be all encompassing. Okay. And I decided how am I going to identify what comments are about WWE and what comments are about AEW? I picked a number of keywords. I don't know if we need to say what they all are, but keywords like AEW, All Elite Wrestling, Dynamite Collision, Rampage, etc. And then for WWE, we're using keywords like WWE, Raw, SmackDown, NXT, WrestleMania, Royal Rumble, SummerSlam. And we did use some executive names here too, including names like Tony Khan, Triple H, HHH, Levesque, Nick Khan, McMahon, Vince McMahon. So things like that.
Did you use Big Tone?
I did not. I did not use TK. I did not. I did not put in here no million as one of our friends suggested I should have. So we collect all these words and I say, all right, so these are the comments. If they contain any of these keywords, and if they don't contain any of the opposite promotions keywords, I'm calling this an AEW comment and I'm calling this a WWE comment. And what we're seeing on the screen for people watching a video is just the volume. This is not the sentiment yet, but this is just the volume of comments with a 12-month trailing average across it. And we can look at this to say, you know, what is the volume of comments been like? And it more or less peaked at least on an average basis for in June of 2022 for AEW. It was much higher for WWE back in the day. Maybe there is some market share of Reddit commenting that AEW's existence is biting into. In any case, so I measured the sentiment. So what is the sentiment? I called up my friend Leon White and I was like, go through all of these comments and just rate them on a scale of -1 to +1. No, that's not true. There is a tool called Vader. What does Vader stand for?
It is Valent. You have it in your story.
It's here. In here somewhere.
Yeah, Valence Aware Dictionary and Sentiment, yes. Reasoner.
Yeah.
Screaming for an acronym. Yeah.
Obviously. So basically it is a tool that has thousands of words in it and that people usually use in a negative or a positive sense. And it does some sort of mathematical magic that I can't explain, but I used it and it takes an entire comment and on a compound basis, it uses some context and it takes the comment as a whole. It decides whether or not this comment was negative, positive, or neutral. So long story short, lo and behold, we get this chart here that measures the sentiment of WWE and AEW over time. And what we see here, is intuitive to me. I wonder if it's intuitive to you, that AEW's positive sentiment peaks around early 2022 or late 2021, and then by mid 2022 it's a downward slope to where they're all virtually tied here. We've got WWE at the end of 2024 ahead for most of the year. Is this a surprise to you?
Not at all. I mean, Tony Khan buys Ring of Honor and it plummeted. I mean, that is the only conclusion I can. No, this lines up. I would think that if anyone out there that has a long-term view of both companies and you were to just draw out a sketch of where you would think that this sentiment would go in both directions, I think a lot of people would probably come to like this. This correlates with the business turnaround for WWE. And I think like you see a graph like this and yeah, this is not, just the be all end all, but I think like this really does tell you like a remarkable rebuild by WWE. And I think that conversely, like you can look at the factors that impacted AEW from mid 2022 onward and that a lot of the things that we assign as vibes, I mean, this backs up kind of like what your consumer response was to both companies during this period. And you can come up with your factors of the switch over from Cody Rhodes going to WWE. And I think CM Punk's name will obviously come up in a lot of people's deduction of this, of where you see like a very, very clear indication of a public opinion that exponentially shifted for WWE over this period.
Yeah, I really missed an opportunity to put vibes in the headline for this, didn't I? And I think as we're going to show here, this aligns pretty well with attendance, which is just about the cleanest consumer metric that we have these days, right? Just to call it, what are the highs and the lows? So I did this on a monthly basis, did a monthly average for each month, and then we've drawn a 12-month moving average across it. And so the low point for WB sentiment was October 2019. Which I can only guess has to do with the terrible Hell in a Cell 2019 finish, which
all backed by Sean Waltman's response on the live watch along.
Right. with their DQ finish at the end of a Hell in a Cell match involving Seth Rollins and Bray Wyatt, the Fiend. The high point for WWE is June 2023, which I can only, I don't know. There's a good Money in the Bank, a well-received Money in the Bank pay-per-view in that month. Anything else?
June of 2023. I mean, yeah, you had the money in the bank. I'm trying to think. It's it's before I'd really have to give it some thought of like what was so pivotal in June of 2023 that would stand out.
So anyway, meanwhile, the high point for AEW in sentiment is June 2022, a year before the last one. So that's Forbidden Door, the first time, right? One of the most highly rated events on Cage Match. I think well over a 9 on Cage Match because I hyperlinked it in here. So, and we still got what? CM Punk is still there. CM Punk has just returned in that month too, right? The volume peaks for Punk's return in August 2022. But yeah, I think you can see a lot of momentum here. It's kind of the peak of the momentum, you know,
that's kind of interesting just as you bring up Punk's return as well. Like June of 2023, I don't know
his return from injury. I mean,
yeah, from injury and coming back from the Brawl Out. I don't know why that would I don't think that would necessarily.
No. This is before Brawl Out, June 2022. This is after his.
I'm going back to the WWE high point doing. Gotcha. June of 2023, that's the launch of Collision, and that's Punk's return from Brawl Out, but that would not necessarily explain a positive uptick for WWE, but I would say that was the most significant events in June of 2023, but...
Right, right.
Anyway, those are, a year apart in June.
So June 2022 is the AEW peak. The AEW low point for a month is April 2024, when... When what happened in April 2024 for AEW, I can only point to something that comes to mind, which is AEW's decision to air the all-in security footage.
Tony Khan said that was a gigantic success for the company. So, and maybe it was. Maybe he has different
metrics. It popped a quarter hour.
In that case, a huge win for them. That is a remarkably low figure that they hit in April of 2024. And I think like it is kind of interesting that we go back and last year was such a positively received WrestleMania and Cody's title win that really felt WWE was on this big upsurge. AEW, I feel, kind of shoots themselves in the foot because you're coming off this big positive momentum for WWE and you're doing something that I think angered even AEW's core defense base that was seeing this as really grasping at straws for attention. This year, however, I think we're seeing a much worse received WrestleMania and a lot more positivity toward the AEW product that has been, it's producing consistently received television. I would not call this a business turnaround, but again, if we are just looking at the general attitude towards AEW, and you have this like right up to the present, which is kind of interesting that of all these like highs and lows, like WWE and AEW, they're sort of at this point now where you go back to 2019, they're not that far off from where you started charting this.
Yeah, and I want to bring up something I didn't even plan to look at here. But I've done these studies where I've looked at the coverage ratings. So where everyone wants to make the excuse that, well, that cord cutting, you can't really analyze TV ratings because of cord cutting. Well, the nice thing about the coverage rating is that it does take into account availability of that cable network. So as that cable network declines in its availability throughout the United States, this is basically a percentage of the people who had access to the network who could have watched. And what we see is, the year-over-year differences, there were two months that had positive year-over-year differences for Dynamite in 2024, but they are April and May. And then after that, into June, we start to see some really severe double-digit negative declines in this coverage rating, both across the demo and total viewership. So I'm not big on like simple explanations about this was the turning point that everybody decided in all these narratives that I'm going to tell about the downturn of AEW. But I mean, it does coincide with that happening. Maybe there's a contributing factor there, or maybe there are other things around that time that also contributed to at least the TV rating trending in the way that it did. To put this image about the sentiment back on the screen. So, and so when did they actually, they start to like really tie in the summer of 2023. So by then, what? Brawl Out has happened. Vince has been, I mean, I've said before, I think you could really look to the summer of 2022 as this real turning point in the direction of both companies. And you have Vince going away for the time being, or the beginning of his downfall. And then you have, Punk having a meltdown in front of the media, along with his injury. And that has really turned the tide in terms of improving the sentiment around WWE, disimproving the sentiment around AEW.
And isn't that there, interesting as well, the fact that we look at that, you know, that first All-In event at Wembley Stadium. It's like the legacy of that show.
Yeah.
Well, to some, it might be, you know, it's the biggest show in the company's history from an attendance standpoint. But I think the legacy of that show that's going to be more reflected in data like this is that was the final straw with CM Punk, and that like Punk overshadowed that show, and not just the ensuing weeks that led up to his release, but really something that dogged them for a long time, perception wise, that I think it's only in the last couple of months that they have, I feel, escaped that shadow of CM Punk and the impact. And again, not to distill it down to one singular figure or one singular story.
You can't emphasize enough. He was by far their biggest star, too. It's not just
unquestionably
the stories here, but you subtracted the biggest star.
You are outlining, Brandon, here, the rise and the fall of CM Punk's AEW tenure. Like, that is what this chart, in many ways, is from 2021 onward. Like, that was, I think everyone looks at the highest point for AEW was that September 2021 that coincided with his first match in the company, and as well the arrival of Bryan Danielson. Like, that was the company riding on significant high, where they graduated to another level with the addition of CM Punk, but that relationship follows this trend downward, and it was a very nasty split by the end that had a lot of negative impact that AEW wore, and Punk not so much. Like, he went to, it was kind of the opposite. It's a weird analogy. It was the opposite of the Montreal Screwjob, where Brett kind of took all the baggage and was bungled in WCW, but the company he left behind thrived in his wake afterward, capitalizing off of that event.
Yeah, that's true. Now, we look at this and say, well, this is just a bunch. This is people online, and everybody online. Just be a fan. Just be a fan, as Paul Levesque has said. Sit back and enjoy, as others have said. These people are irrelevant, and even other fans will tell you that other fans are irrelevant and their opinions don't matter. I had a wide range of reactions to this study being published. Everything from John Pollock saying this is the most ambitious project I've ever engaged in, to somebody else saying, I think, by far the dumbest thing this guy has ever written about. But this has no basis in reality or broader consumer metrics, right? Well, I've got R's and R squareds for you to deal with, okay? And we've got this study aligning, this sentiment aligning pretty well with AEW's attendance. And I'm looking to attendance because, you know, we can put away TV ratings that have all of their external problems. They're going to have even more external problems in the era of streaming, where streaming is potentially having an impact on traditional TV viewing. So let's look to just to attendance. And I think a good set of data to look to is let's look at the weekly TV attendance for their weekly TV shows, because these are shows that happen every week. Let's put them all together. And in fact, if you take the Collision timeline and you put it next to the Rampage timeline of events, you get a pretty continuous set of events along with the Dynamite events that we put with it. Okay. And what we find there is a pretty strong math nerds gather around. This is a pretty strong relationship. I did quarterly averages here. I'm looking at the average attendance for each quarter. I'm looking at the average, I'm looking at the 12 month trailing average, quarterly average sentiment. And what we get is a 0.82 correlation, Pearson correlation result, which means a perfect relationship would be a 1.0. So we get a strong relationship here. The R squared, which is how predictive it is, a 1.0 would be perfect. This is a 6.8. So a pretty strong relationship. Complete randomness would be a 0. So this is far from random. The WWE relationship for Raw and SmackDown attendance is weaker. But not insignificant. We get a 0.68 for the R. We get a 0.47 for the R squared, which a moderate relationship, I would say.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
I find this to be really interesting, just in terms of, and this dovetails well on the discussion we had with Jesse Callings about his fan survey that he did, that I'm sure you could draw several inferences as well between both of these studies of kind of where AEW is at in terms of a public perception. The why, we'll leave that for Reddit to answer why these are the attitudes of fans.
Yeah, and we can look at the individual keywords that I used. I'm going to cause some more trouble here, but let's look at just the AEW keyword and the WWE keyword. There's this chart that anybody can mess around with here to look at all the individual keywords and how they average over time. Okay, and we see similar story to the story with everything bundled together is that, you know, there's separation. AEW has this big lead throughout much of the timeline. Now it's basically equal. And if we start to put the executive names on here, like... let's put Triple H on here. Triple H has so many different names that we have to account for, including HHH, including Levesque is also in here. And like, do we see this big improvement from the resignation of Vince the first time in summer of 2022, and then it sort of normalizes. There's less chatter, unfortunately, about Nick Khan probably on Reddit, but he improves over time too.
Type in CM Punk. I'm curious to see how he.
I don't have CM Punk on here, so I did not put Punk wrestler names in here.
Gotcha. Okay.
I do have his. I did run his data somewhere, and I think it goes similarly to the AEW. I would have to look. But CM Punk, I did not put wrestler names in here because which bucket does he go in? I could have like put him in, but then we're talking about wrestlers' careers and the passions that fans have and right. Happiness or unhappiness they have about somebody's booking. Okay. But we do see a decline for Tony Khan here, beginning summer of 2022, probably, you know, so turns around the timing of Brawl Out. It does recover a bit in late 2024. And we can follow up about they do post the monthly data for this stuff on Academic Torrents, so I could follow up on this and do year to date.
We hold our breath for month by month data of this the subsection that is Reddit. And you are breaking news to me that there was even a WWE, like, I'm not surprised there's a WWE subreddit, but I will admit I have never gone to it in my life.
There's a WWE subreddit? I think there's an AEW subreddit.
I'm sure there are, yes. I'm not a big Reddit user, but Squared Circle is the extent of my wrestling viewing on Reddit. So
I look at the new tab of Reddit, like, all day, and I have it on an automatic refresh, so you're welcome for all the hits. But it does keep, you know, it lets me know if there's some news that I'm missing.
You can check out this whole study at WrestleNomics.com. It's free for everybody to check out, and you can draw your own conclusions. But I think there's a lot of correlation that people will see here that there's and trying to decipher like positive from negative. Yeah. And
there's a lot of other projects I could do with this data. We could look at New Japan, for instance. We could look at individual wrestlers. It'd be interesting.
All right, let's chat a little bit about TKO as we're going late here, but the first quarter earnings report is going to be coming out Thursday with a call with analysts on Thursday evening, and they are also coming off. How big of a factor do you expect this TKO boxing entity to be focused on? They just held this big event at outside in Times Square this past Friday, which... from boxing fans, this was a complete disaster with some atrocious fights. And Thomas Hauser at The Guardian has a really great piece on just the logistical nightmare that this was. But this is...
I've not heard anything about this. Tell me about it.
So Turki Alsheikh had... They had they were working with various entities in New York, and they were going to host a free set of boxing fights in the middle of Times Square on Friday evening. Originally,
New Yorker has covered this, the spectacle of a boxing match in Times Square.
Yeah, it turned into just like Ryan Garcia, who is an exceptionally problematic figure. See his tweets. Had a horrendous performance, losing to like a 12-1 favorite, and he ended up losing this fight. Two of the fights ended up, I believe this stat off the top of my head, in the 40 years of CompuBox tabulating stats, two of the lowest punch totals were recorded in, like two of these fights were among the top five lowest recorded punch stats in the history of their database. So it tells you the action was not great. The idea of having thousands of spectators here in Times Square did not turn out to be the case. They were limited to like 300 people in this enclosed area. So it was more so like you were walking by a construction site. They wanted to broadcast all of the fights on, and rent out all the screens in Times Square to play the fights. They were told you cannot do that because there's going to be too much bottlenecking among spectators. It was logistically nuts. And on top of that, they ended up putting this on pay-per-view on DAZN. So the idea of this being like for the boxing fans was not quite the case. And of course, this was pretty much an infomercial for Turki Alşık's version or vision of boxing. But are you aware there was also a big
TKO involved, really?
Well, that is to my next topic. They had a special pre-show, and there to host were TKO's own Pat McAfee and Booker T, and they got time with Turki Alşık, and I was very interested to hear this interview. And
did they ask him about the athletic report?
Well, let's hear some of those highlights of the hard-hitting questions that Turki was asked.
Can you tell me about the importance of Fatal Fury, City of the Wolves, just to this event, but to like everything?
No, you talk about the lifeblood of boxing and the lifeblood of the fighters as well. How important it is for you to actually be able to help facilitate these boxers, because I always talk about the Ali Act. The Ali Act is all about, you know, taking care of the boxers. And now, with your help, the boxers are going to be in such better places than they've ever been.
And I see you tweet, we're bad for boxing or something like that. I assume you get a chip on your shoulder about people that think that you won't be able to make boxing the number one sport. I heard you're a gamer.
Yeah.
I heard the Crown Prince, God bless him, also a gamer.
He's focusing as a business also for the country and the companies of the game. Yeah.
Are you going to Fatal Fury?
I will fight with you after we finish.
All right. We appreciate you for everything.
That was just some of the highlights of the interview with Turki Alşık. Fatal Fury, by the way, was the sponsor, this video game that was sponsoring this whole event. Yes. That Turki Alşık is involved in. What I enjoyed about that was...
also a WWE sponsor.
Yes. Also a WWE sponsor. For Booker T, like just the most pablum of questions about the Ali Act and how great it is what TKO is going to do with the Ali Act. Pat McAfee, on the other hand... He might play this guy that is just like, oh, I'm not a journalist and such. This guy absolutely read that article on The Athletic, and he just like tiptoes around. I hear you're a gamer. Yes, because you read about this and the fact that this guy threw a tantrum after two goals were scored on him when he was playing FIFA 20 and broadcast this. He also mentioned, you know, when you get a chip on your shoulder, when you read things on Twitter. Yes, a chip on your shoulder and a one-way passport to the tutu wing of the prison in Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, it's like Pat McAfee is dancing around it as like a wink that I've absolutely read this article. I'm not going to confront him about any of these things, but I'm going to give you enough coded language to know that I am very aware of the instances that were brought up in this article, such as I know you're a gamer.
So it's kind of how he interviewed Hogan, right? He's like, you have any regrets?
It's like, I'm just going to put out this plate of cookies. And if you care to take a cookie, you're welcome to, but no pressure. And, this event was, again, I'm not the biggest boxing consumer, but it seemed like this was universally panned by people in terms of what it was set out to do. And just for boxing fans leaving it, just very unsatisfied. But the bigger news long term is that after Canelo Alvarez's fight on Saturday in Saudi Arabia, they announced that the first TKO boxing event will take place September 12th. At Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas with Canelo fighting Terrence Crawford. and this will be promoted by Dana White and Nick Khan, and that will be their unofficial launch, with a major fight, obviously, in Canelo and Terrence Crawford. And while not official, many people thinking that Netflix would be the distribution arm for this fight, but that is not official. I think like the boxing component will be brought up a lot in this earnings call, and doubling down on the fact that they are in this as promoters and not as...
They're just getting a fee, right? So is this going to bring in a lot of costs on them? I guess not. And that's really the message that they want to get across, is that we're just getting
all of these costs are underwritten by Saudi Arabia, and we are doing what is our expertise, and that is promotion. And I think that is going to be the message here. But other things you're just looking toward in this call, if there's anything that stands out, I mean, the other...
I did not realize this call was coming up until you emailed me the other day with a list of topics for today. It's Q1. What happened interesting in Q1? I'm sure there'll be some highlights of WrestleMania and how amazingly successful WrestleMania was, which it was. I don't expect a lot of
first quarter with Netflix, obviously.
And WrestleMania happened after the quarter, but they'll highlight the most recent news. Yeah.
And I imagine like the topics, if there's several about boxing, I think even more so on just the status of the Peacock deal and the UFC rights. Like obviously those are the big things on the table. And I guess it will be interesting to see if we get any Nick Khan. Nick is on the line. He's going to field this question or
throw to him. And Paul might even be there too. It's always fun when they have run-ins on these calls.
Yeah. Actually, we've got Stephanie here. She's going to talk about Stephanie's Places, available now on ESPN.
I don't think she's on the call at this point.
No, probably not. Maybe they could find her on her cell. That is coming up on Thursday evening. These calls are not as newsworthy as they once were, but sometimes you always get a few nuggets in these calls. We'll see if they align on anything else. So probably more site fee talk. We're going back to Australia. We have still not got the official confirmation of the calendar for Saudi Arabia shows for WWE this year. I think it's WrestleVotes has reported that they're expected to go there at the end of June, and the fall card might just end up being absorbed into this Royal Rumble event in next January, whenever the date is for the Royal Rumble.
That would make sense, I guess, right? If you say, well, a typical Saudi PLE is $50 million. Well, we should probably get something more for doing the Royal Rumble there. And maybe it's just a fact of, well, we don't have to conduct and incur the expense of doing an extra show right before it. And therefore, Royal Rumble is worth double the value of a typical event there. That seems to make sense, but that's a guess.
On a few AEW notes, they begin back-to-back nights in Detroit tonight and tomorrow. They're doing a live Collision on Thursday at the Masonic Temple Hall. So, for the second show in a row, they'll avoid a WWE PLE with Backlash on Saturday night. And they're bringing in the big gun. Rhino has been announced for these cards. If you want to ask why are they booking Rhino, go to AEW's page on X and look at all the local media he was able to get on. That's why Rhino's on these cards. And they have also announced...
Go ahead.
Oh, that's all.
Is Master P coming tonight?
No, he was there a few weeks ago in New Orleans.
That was that many weeks ago. Okay.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. That's how close I'm following.
They've announced their residency for Philadelphia end of August into September. 7 shows at the 2300 Arena, probably an 8th with this combined show they're doing with Action Wrestling and Segunda Caída for the Dean 3. It will be in September. So, three Dynamites, 3 Collisions, and ROH Death Before Dishonor at the 2300 Arena, which is probably going to be set up for 800, 1,000 at best that they will have to fill. But it's 7 shows as well. And it's going to be a lot of, how many times these audiences will come out for these shows, I guess is the question.
Yeah. I mean, it's keeping costs way down, and it's a very wrestling, wrestling associated venue.
A note from a guest on this show, John Nash, over at the Hey Not the Face podcast. So in the Kung Lee lawsuit, apparently there are 1,115 fighters that have all been reached out to get their settlement. 73 fighters have yet to verify their information to claim their money. And they have until June 16th to verify, or else their amount will go into the pool and be dispersed among the other fighters that have claimed their information. Why is this relevant? Among the 73 fighters that have not claimed their money yet, Brock Lesnar, who John Nash estimates is owed about $3.5 million he stands to make in this settlement. So I really hope that they are able to get this message to Brock Lesnar.
$3.5 million.
$3.5 million is what John Nash estimates he is going to get in this settlement.
Well, Brock, if he's listening or any people close to Brock, he's got $3.5 million coming to him. Just
this is literally the easiest $3.5 million you will ever make. It's pretty much putting down your information into an online form. You don't even have to leave your house. Although I believe Rena Mero had stated a long time ago, they don't even have the internet. I don't think.
And they're married. Yes.
Others include BJ Penn, Alexander Volkanovsky, and Valentina Shevchenko as well. Shevchenko, who is fighting on Saturday night in Montreal. I cannot fathom that they're not aware of this, but they have much less to make. They only had a couple of fights in this class period that ended at the end of June 2017. So great money if you can make it. Just, hey, sign a form. We'll give you $3.5 million, or else these other fighters, they'll get $3.5 million spread among 1,100 fighters.
Do you earn any goodwill with Dana White if you decline to accept this money?
None, because UFC doesn't get any of this money back. They have paid out the settlement, so it's only a matter of which fighters are going to get this lump sum. It doesn't matter to them at all if Brock gets the $3.5 million or the other fighters get it. UFC gets none of this money back. There's no.
And you just said they're sharing. If somebody doesn't claim their money, the rest of them just share it.
Exactly. If you and I were in the fighter class and we were to make $50, and then Brock declines this, it would mean probably like $10 more for us, the way it trickles down. So, okay. I am sure there are some fighters that have the exact reaction you do about not wanting to accept this and be in the crosshairs of UFC. This should make no difference to UFC because they're paying this regardless. They get none of this back. It's only a matter of which fighters get what amount out of this. And the final notes, let's just go through a couple of ratings notes from the last couple of days. So SmackDown on Friday did 1,406,000 viewers and a 0.37 in the 18 to 49 demo. Among their lowest numbers on the USA Network, however, they were third for the night in primetime in the demo. This is pretty much it was just the NBA that beat them on Friday night. So, I mean, even with a reduced audience, it's still among the most watched shows, and you're beating everything but the NBA.
Yeah, as you said, it was the lowest since November in the demo. It was the lowest in what? Just over a month in total. So it's NBA playoffs.
More reasons to frighten me about these 3-hour SmackDowns. Just if I hear a last minute deal has been
was supposed to go to two at the I think the end of June or the beginning of June. I have to look at what I was told.
My fingers are crossed. But again, we will see what happens there. Collision on Saturday was moved over to TBS to accommodate the NBA on TNT, which did a very big number, and Collision did not. They got pretty much they came off that tremendous number the previous week because of the NBA lead-in. This week was the opposite. They were against the NBA without a lead-in, so they fell 52% in viewers, which is much like last week was unrealistically high. This is like you look at these decreases and they're alarming, but they're coming off an aberration type of number. Their demo was down to a 0.06, so that's not 73% this week. And their 18 to 34 number fell from 117,000 viewers last week to 16,000 this week. So, I mean, I would almost just write off both of these weeks, the high and the low of all of this, because this would paint a pretty nasty picture, but last week also painted a ridiculously optimistic view of where Collision would be based on.
Well, if you want credit for when Collision has an enormous lead-in, you should take responsibility when it is preempted and does less well than usual.
Yeah, that often doesn't happen. They usually just choose one of those available options.
Or just exclude all the preemptions.
That could be another option as well. And then Raw on a week ago Monday, so this would be the April 28th episode, was down to 3 million views globally and 5.8 million hours viewed, which ranked fourth globally. condensed down to an hour and 51 minutes. So
the shortest Raw on Netflix to date.
Which is bizarre because I am not watching Raw for an hour and 51 minutes, but is my stat total as if I was watching an hour and 51 minute show? I'm watching for 2.5 hours minimum.
Then you contributed to the 5.8 million hours viewed here.
Okay.
You contributed that much to it.
Well,
it's like that number, according to Netflix, is determined by however much time you were watching it, even though the duration changes depending on when you watch it, as you know, whether you watch it live, which is probably the longest way to watch it, or if you watch it later without commercials or something, right?
I would be happy with every wrestling show being an hour and 51 minutes.
Yeah.
Period. US, it ranked third. Canada, it was seventh. And it ranked among the usual suspects. It seems like India, it's now consistently ranked in the top 10. UK, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, maybe Turkey and MBS. They were up late playing League of Legends, Fatal Fury, and watching WWE on Netflix. Okay, there's your ratings notes. Anything else you wanted to touch upon, Brandon, before we wrap up here?
We have something very, very important to touch upon here. Skylar G says, bad R-squared explanation.
Ooh.
So let's explain R-squared in a more accurate fashion. So the R-squared is a coefficient of determination. I do R-squareds all the time. I might have done a bad job explaining it, but I do know what an R-squared is. It is a statistic used in the context of statistical models whose main purpose is either the prediction of future outcomes or the testing of hypotheses on the basis of other related information. It provides a measure of how well observed outcomes are replicated by the model based on the proportion of total variation of outcomes explained by the model.
Got it. Everyone understands. You're welcome. Everyone's just nodding their head.
Yes.
So yeah, don't call Brandon out on R squared. Okay. Let's take a light question here on international tariffs. Jake from the Windy City. I'm curious, in the midst of tariffs and many not wanting to travel to the U.S., if you know international tourism for WrestleMania has been affected this year at all. I don't think like there's going to be any,
they sold those tickets. So
they sold those tickets. And I think if we're going to see any like kind of tourism affecting WWE, it's going to be reflected in future shows. I think like this, I would think
a lot of the traveling fan is domestic anyway, but a lot of it is international.
Yeah. That WrestleMania is going to be like more so if next year's show shows like an impact, like maybe you can look at that. I wouldn't look at this year as having as like any impact on international tourism. I think most people had probably plotted out their trips in advance of these tariffs. And I think it'll maybe be something in the future if it's going to be an issue at all, when it comes to live attendance. But that is it for us. We have gotten through all of our topics here. There was a lot to get to, a lot of legal breakdowns of various cases going on. You can find more over at WrestleNomics.com. Go sift through all the millions and millions of Reddit comments, and you can subscribe to WrestleNomics both at Patreon.com/WrestleNomics and on Substack, where Brandon is keeping you up to date. And quarter hour breakdown of Collision that is up there now for everyone to see what worked, what did not work on TBS this past Saturday night going against the NBA. And again, a big recommendation to the big exhaustive study into Reddit that is available now for all members of WrestleNomics, free or otherwise.
Yes. And the data reports, not just with TV ratings. Okay, if you think TV ratings don't matter, well, there's attendance data in there. There's YouTube data in there. There's even some reception data in there. But I heard that Wei Ting is back.
Wei Ting has returned from his the recent addition to his family. So we are going to be sitting down with Wei Ting for a very special edition of Talk on Thursday at postwrestlingcafe.com. $6 gets you access to all of the extra shows, including Talk, which Wei and I will be dropping on Thursday. Almost no wrestling talk that will be featured in this. So that's the big selling feature. No wrestling talk with Wei Ting and myself.
Just journeys and fatherhood, I expect.
Yes, yes. We're going to find out how Wei Ting is still standing after having his second child. So welcome to the world, Lucas Ting. And that is it for us, everyone. Thank you to all of you checking into the show. We're back every Wednesday 1 p.m. Eastern time. And we're going to do, we're going to let someone else take us out this week among my my clip gathering. We're going to give the final word to Pete Buttigieg. He's going to take us out. We'll talk to you next week.
We see things like randomly sending incredibly sensitive information to the wrong people or any of the other things that are going on. It raises concerns, and it raises more concerns because it's part of a pattern, right? So you got the Secretary of Defense playing fast and loose with classified information. You've got the Secretary of Education saying that we need to make sure kids are trained in something she calls A1, which means she doesn't understand that it's AI, which means she doesn't understand artificial intelligence.
It's not A1 steak sauce, everyone.
Right. Like, I love A1 steak sauce, but A1 steak sauce is not one of the most important things confronting humanity right now. Artificial intelligence is. And somebody who doesn't understand that probably should not be leading an important federal agency.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.